David Kuman here from the Israel Institute of New Zealand. I'm with Alex Ripchin, who's the CEO of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry and author of The Anti-Israel Agenda, Inside the Political War on the Jewish State. We have a review of this book up on our website, but why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
The book brings together some of the finest minds devoted to the question of Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So it's got people like Hillel Neuer, Gerald Steinberg, Colonel Richard Kemp, Alan Dershowitz, and together we look at how the conflict with Israel has shifted from one of traditional military confrontation and then terrorism to now taking place in the forums of greatest political and moral influence in the world. So it's now battle waged in the United Nations, in the trade unions and political parties, on social media, in the church, every forum that touches and concerns our lives. And the aim of this war remains the same, which is to bring about the downfall of the Jewish state and end any autonomous Jewish presence in the Middle East. And with the failure of military confrontation, conventional invasion, terrorism, to drive the Jewish people from their land, we now see this third tier of the conflict.
But when I hear that, I immediately think to the last 7 weeks or so on the Gaza border, and yeah, terrorism is well and truly still alive.
Sure.
So it hasn't gone away.
No.
If we touch briefly on the Gaza border, yeah, there's been also a little bit of misunderstandings around what's been going on. So
that's putting it mildly, yeah.
What are the major misunderstandings in your mind?
Well, you raise an excellent point, and that's that while the conflict has now shifted to international forums, the earlier tactics of invasion, of war, of terrorism, you're quite right, they haven't gone away. But what's changed is that whereas initially the aims of those tactics was to actually bring about the downfall of the state, since particularly the Yom Kippur War was realized that Israel can't be dislodged through force alone, and war and terrorism are now used less to achieve military outcomes and more to drive the propaganda war against Israel, to attract constant media attention, to produce NGO reports, UN fact-finding missions, and all of this propels forward the political war on Israel, aimed at bringing about its isolation and then its downfall. So in reference to what's going on in Gaza, this plays into this perfectly. Every time Hamas provokes Israel into a war, there is no military objective to be served. And they know this. They know that Israel is the most powerful fighting force in the region, and it can't be defeated through conventional military means. But they know that war is a wonderful way of increasing support for the Palestinian cause and awareness of the cause in the West. It's a way for the media to remain completely focused on the conflict, and that really plays into their agenda.
But surely if the media reported that there was terrorism still happening, it wouldn't play into anyone's agenda. If sane readers read that there is a terrorist, how does that help?
The trouble is that we in the West tend to transplant our own ideas and values into the conflict. So because we're rational actors, we think that someone trying to penetrate a border fence or someone armed with a grenade or a Molotov cocktail, they must have some rational cause, something must have driven them to this point. And the truth is something has, and that's sheer hatred, a desire to annihilate the Jews and drive us from the land. That's what gets us to this point. But we in the West here want to believe that it's down to some rational motives. They were somehow provoked. It's a legitimate act of protest or self-defense. And what we really need to do is stop interposing our own values and views onto the conflict. Actually listen to what the Palestinians are saying. Listen to what the perpetrators of this violence are saying. They have said very clearly that their aim is to rip the hearts out of the chests of the Jews. It's to remove what they call the transient border. It's to reclaim what they view as their ancestral homeland, being the entirety of the State of Israel. So while this has been framed almost universally as being peaceful, non-violent protests, it has a very violent motive.
And the acts are violent as well, or has there been only peaceful protests?
There's naturally a mix. So tens of thousands of people have been gathered there on the border, and the vast majority have probably not engaged in any acts of violence, but the vast majority haven't been fired upon either. But to say that they're entirely peaceful is utterly insane. There is no civil society in Gaza. Everything that happens there, every form of assembly, every form of protest, is coordinated by Hamas. There is no free will or freedom of assembly there. And everything that Hamas does is with a violent motive. This is a group that is constituted solely for the purpose of annihilating the Jewish people and destroying the state of Israel. And if those in the West want to play into this fallacy, this lunacy, that these protests have some sort of peaceful intent behind them, that's just utterly repugnant.
So there have obviously been a lot of media reports on what's been happening. Some politicians have even spoken out. I don't know if it's the same in Australia. What can be done to counter that false narrative?
The only way to counter lies is with truth, of course, and often it's difficult and often it's frustrating, but you have to persevere in these things. There's a lot of misinformation, there's a lot of, in some cases, honest errors on the parts of politicians when they come out and talk about disproportionate response on the Israeli side, when they think that proportionality can be measured by comparing body counts on the two sides, which is nothing at all what proportionality means under international law. Proportionality is concerned with the threat posed and the response to that threat. So really, it's necessary to counter this through our own repetition, by clarifying what the law is, clarifying the facts, and hoping that eventually the truth will prevail.
Right, so let's shift a little bit from Gaza. There's also been the Iran deal that Donald Trump has pulled out of, the embassy move. There's been a lot of shifts that have been going on recently. What are your takes on those two particular issues?
They're very interesting issues. And with the Iran deal, or what looks like the collapse of the Iran deal, I think this is a good thing. And what Donald Trump has done in re-examining the Iran deal, he's taken a whole new approach in engaging with Iran. So previously, under the Obama administration, and the position of Europe has been to look at Iran's nuclear ambitions on the one hand, and look at everything it does, all its malevolent dealings in the region, its support for terrorism, its propping up of the Assad regime, of Hezbollah, of the Houthis in Yemen, all of these things that it does as being somehow divorced from the nuclear issue. So, and the view was that the Iran deal deals with the nuclear issue and we'll deal with everything else separately. And Donald Trump has now terminated that line of thinking, that fiction. And he's basically said that the Iran deal needs to be renegotiated to look at Iranian action, Iranian interests, the Iranian agenda in its totality. And what was happening in reality was that while Iran had concluded the deal, and perhaps it was complying with it, it was using the cover of that deal to increase its belligerence in the form of a ballistic missile test, for example. Its support for the Assad regime, its support for Hezbollah, its support for terrorism, funding for terrorism. So it was using the sanctions relief that came from the Iran deal. It was using the greater international legitimacy that came from the deal to actually do worse things in the region. And I think with the end of the Iran deal, or what looks like the end of it, I think we'll see a whole new way of engaging with Iran, which will hopefully lead to a more peaceful region.
And in terms of how it's viewed in Australia, how does the Australian government view the shift in US policy towards the Iran deal and withdrawing from it?
So the position of the Australian government was similar to that of European governments, which was basically to favour a continuation of the deal on the basis that it's perhaps the worst of all, the least worst of all possible options. But I think we'll see a new deal come into shape in the near future. I think we'll see renegotiation of the Iran deal, hopefully on better terms. And I think once that happens, the Australian government and European governments will be more supportive of it.
That's the one big recent news. Yeah. And the other one, of course, is the embassy moving to Jerusalem, the US embassy recently. So how was that perceived in Australia?
There were mixed reactions to it. So the view of the government was not to criticise the announcement, but they also didn't say that they would follow suit, which is fine. The Australian government is remarkably supportive of the State of Israel. They have extensive ties across a whole range of fields. And Australia has been unflinching in its support for Israel in international forums, particularly in the UN Human Rights Council and the General Assembly and elsewhere. So I think the Australian government will in time consider this issue as well. And once they see that the sky hasn't fallen in by relocating the embassy and recognising Jerusalem as the capital, I believe in time they'll follow suit. And the view of the majority of Australians has been quite interesting as well. So my organisation conducted some polling to test attitudes towards a whole range of aspects of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including the question of Jerusalem. and the majority of Australians believe that Australia should recognise Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So I think without public support and with America taking the lead and other governments now following suit, I think in time Australia and hopefully New Zealand as well will do likewise.
Well, we've certainly voiced our support for the move and said the New Zealand government should follow suit, but unfortunately there hasn't been the political support. But we also have done some polling and know that the majority of Kiwis would support the move.
Yeah.
It's just our government is not so supportive. But that's an interesting position for Australia to take because they have been supportive of Israel generally. Yeah. And one of the other recent announcements over there is that there's now seem to be questions asked over the funding to UN, to UNRWA, the UN aid organization for the Palestinians. Where do you think that might go?
For a long time, my community has expressed concern about where Australian taxpayer money is going in the Palestinian territories. And there have been a number of cases that have suggested that some of that money might be siphoned off for the purposes of terrorism or building terror tunnels and whatnot. And the other concern is even when that money isn't used for those malicious purposes, any money going to UNRWA really entrenches the Palestinians in the sense of perpetual victimhood. It keeps them in refugee camps when they have no reason to be in refugee camps. I mean, a lot of these camps are located in territory which they themselves control. So by funding UNRWA, it really keeps them in that state, and it doesn't do anything to advance peace. It keeps the Palestinians rooted in the past, wanting to, you know, play out old grievances from the 1948 war and so forth. So I believe all funding to the Palestinians needs to be looked at, not just from a criminal point of view, but is this actually doing anything to advance the interests of peace? The Palestinians receive $1.2 billion US a year in aid. They are by far the greatest recipient per capita in the world, far more than Somalia, Ethiopia, Congo. So it's difficult to see why the Palestinians are so much more deserving of this aid than other people. And it's also difficult to see what return on that aid we can actually see in terms of progress and peace.
So with the questions being asked of the Australian government, do you see them cutting funding like the US has done to UNRWA?
I don't think they'll necessarily cut funding, but I think they'll very closely examine whether that money is going for the purposes for which it's intended, which is for society building and peace building and humanitarian relief. And there's some serious questions to be asked about that. And I think that if the answer to those questions is that it's not being used in the way that it's intended, then surely the Australian government will look at more valuable ways of spending that aid.
Sure. So that kind of brings us full circle back to the UN, which is where a lot of the political warfare has been playing out. So there was some Security Council resolutions and now a General Assembly resolutions about the Gaza conflict. Give us your few thoughts about the UN as it stands at the moment vis-a-vis the Israel-Palestinian conflict.
I think there's been a clear shift, and that's with the ascent of, again, the Trump administration and particularly his appointment of Nikki Haley to be his ambassador, the United States ambassador in the United Nations. And that has been a real positive. There's very little good news that comes out of the UN, but the fact that Nikki Haley is now there is really an extraordinary gain, an extraordinary development. And also the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, I believe is a good man. I've heard him speak a number of times. And he has been unequivocal in his support for Israel. While being critical of it in some aspects, he's also denounced anti-Zionism as the modern form of anti-Semitism, which is really important. So it just goes to show that even some of the most problematic forums in the world, with enough time, with enough, you know, hard slogging away, things can change. And there's a lesson to be drawn from that for all of us, and that's that you have to stay in these forums. You have to be in it to win it. You have to continue to work even when it seems difficult, even when it seems like you're getting nowhere, but you can gradually over time change minds, build support, and actually change the way whole institutions view Israel and the conflict.
Do you think the UN is changing its view about Israel and the conflict?
I think it'll be a very slow process, and obviously the odds are stacked against us because there's an automatic majority against Israel and the United Nations, and that's an automatic majority of non-aligned groups, of autocratic regimes, of Arab and Islamic states. So it's always going to be very difficult. But again, I'm seeing some positives. So for example, about a year or so ago, some obscure UN agency based in Beirut produced a report authored by the notorious conspiracy theorist Richard Falk, where he accused Israel of being an apartheid state and so forth and so on, the usual stuff. And within hours of that report going online, it was then pulled, and the head of that agency was actually sacked. So again, it shows that slowly but surely, if you speak the truth often enough and clearly enough, change is possible.
Great. Well, I certainly hope that change is possible. And part of the change is the anti-Israel agenda, shedding some light and speaking some truth to the anti-Israel agenda. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming out, Alex.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And enjoy the rest of your stay.
I will. Thank you, David. Cheers.